This is it. This is the last talk about Ruth that you will probably hear in a while. For me, anyway. I'm done. I've had it. No more Ruth. This morning, we'll be looking at mostly the fourth chapter. And if I had to title it, last time it was what really happened on the threshing floor. And this week, maybe we could say what really happened at the city gate. Because right after the threshing floor comes the city gate. And there's some interesting things that happen there. And really wraps the story up. And without it, it would be sort of this cliffhanger. And you're wondering what's going on. But just to reiterate, the story of Ruth, as I've said before, and I will continue to say, is about chesed. And chesed is loving kindness. It's really what God is, and it's what God expects of his people. It's what he expects of everybody. When he created the world, when he created people, I see God's intention was that we practice and be chesed, loving kindness, showing love, showing kindness toward each other, and looking out for each other in community, in family, wherever. It's what God is, and he expects us to be a reflection of himself. Of course, we know we live in a world that's sometimes completely the opposite. But this story, Ruth, is a shining beacon, I think, in the Bible, where in the midst of a lot of turmoil, it's at the end of the Judges period. And if you read through Judges, if you've ever listened to the stories of Judges, there's some really horrible things that went on. Really horrible things. And it kind of reminds me of the stories I hear in the news right now. I almost want to shut my ears to what's going on in the world right now, just because it's so horrible. It's like, it's more horrible than I've ever heard before, really. That I'm living at such a time. Anyway, Ruth is in the context of horrible times, and yet the people in it started showing loving kindness toward each other. And it's a shining beacon. So, what we're going to look at today, generally, we've kind of moved. Ruth is a lot about women. It's a lot about Naomi. It's a lot about Ruth. And now, sort of in the final chapter, it switches to a story about men. And in particular, Boaz. And this fourth chapter of Ruth shows how Ruth's chesed, her loving kindness towards Naomi, and then towards Boaz, leads Boaz to act as a goel. Now, last time we kind of looked at this word goel. It means kinsman redeemer. It's a redeemer, and it's a very, very important part of the Jewish law, the law that God gave. And even before that, too, it was an important part. But God kind of codified it there at the mountain when he gave the law to Moses, and he put it in there. And he said, when you go into your land, and I give it to you, each person, each family will have land. They will have something in order to sustain themselves. And that was really important. It's like having a bank account with or an investment that's, if you use it wisely, then it'll always provide for you. And that's what land was. So if you didn't have that, then you really had nothing. So God said, if you're to get into a situation where you lose your land for whatever reason, you can get it back by a redeemer, a kinsman, a relative of yours, stepping up and saying, I will buy it back on your behalf. And it also went as far as buying you back. If you had to sell yourself into servitude because of, you know, the situations in life, and you had to sell yourself into some sort of servant role where you had to sort of work for someone else for a certain period of time in order to pay off debts. Then you could either go through that, you know, or a kinsman could step up and say, I will buy them back and I will pay the price for you so that you don't have to be in servitude anymore. And it's a very important part of the law. And those that did so, that were goel, were on hero status, really, within the community. Because it was a huge thing to do. And it was Ruth at the threshing floor that sort of prompted and prodded Boaz to do this. Because earlier, and as we'll see in this chapter, we go from the threshing floor to the city gate. And at the threshing floor, Ruth comes to Boaz in the middle of the night in very weird circumstances that make it look almost, it's a good word. It almost looks a little risque, the way she does it. And really, a lot of scholars said, well, it was risque. It was a strange situation, and we really can't wrap our heads around it. But it seems that Ruth and Naomi were at a critical juncture in their lives, and they had to do something. So it sort of prompted them to do things that they would not otherwise have done. And now, just as a sidebar, Ruth is not about what to do in particular situations, okay? In fact, the Bible, in a lot of the Bible, it's not about what to do in these particular situations. Quite often the Bible is just an account of how people acted, good or bad, and what God did in those situations. And Ruth is not really a commentary on whether Ruth did the right thing and come into Boaz in the middle of the night. Maybe she shouldn't. The fact is, she did. And it turned out okay. So, at the threshing floor, Ruth comes to Boaz, and she reminds him of what he had said to her earlier in the harvest. And he had said, may God bless you. May God spread his wings over you to protect you and provide for you. So it's sort of this arm's length kind of thing, right? And we see that in James earlier on, or later on. There's a section in James that says, it's not enough to just bless somebody and say, you know what, be at peace. Go forth and peace be upon you. And may God provide you with all the blessings. That's great. That's a nice thing to say. But Ruth then, at the threshing floor, she comes forward and she says, I want you, Boaz, to spread your wings over me. And that you, Boaz, be God's instrument in bringing peace and redemption to my life, to Naomi's life. And now this is where the rubber meets the road for Boaz. What's he going to do? And it turns out is that he's thrilled to pieces to be able to do this for Ruth, because he blesses her again, and he tells her what a strong woman she is. And in fact, there's a key verse for today that he says, verse 11 of chapter 3. No, it's not verse 11. It is verse 11. It says, now don't worry about a thing, my daughter. I will do what is necessary, for everyone in town knows you are a virtuous woman. And literally what that means is that, literally in the Hebrew, what it says is that everyone in the gate knows that you are an eshet chayil, a virtuous woman, a woman of valor, is what it means literally. It's the same word that's used of the woman of Proverbs, at the end of Proverbs. A virtuous woman of valor. It's one of the highest compliments you could give a woman. And so now we know what Boaz thinks of Ruth, right? He thinks she's pretty awesome. And he says, don't worry about a thing. I will take care of everything. And so now we go from a very private, in the middle of the night, scenario to a very public, in the middle of the day, scenario. It's a total change of context. And we've gone from the woman's world, where we get a lot of women's perspective on what is happening, to now a man's perspective of what they do at that time. And the two worlds seem, in Ruth, to act in harmony. Although they seem to be very separate, and the man's world is very much sort of like, it's out there, and very public, it seems to necessarily depend a lot on what happens in the women's world, because you can see the kinds of maneuverings that Naomi and Ruth did in order to get an action happening on Boaz's part, which happened in a more public sphere. What's more important? Yes, they both were. And that sort of, as pointed out in Ruth, and my computer's being lazy. So now we go to the city gate. Now, just as a way to put this in context, this is not Bethlehem, but it is it's what they could find of another city in that same area. I think that's Beersheba. A little bit later on, but typical. It's a typical kind of town. And at the time, when cities were walled, they're walled for very good reasons. They're walled to keep out, initially, before people started really fighting each other, they're walled to keep out animals, dangerous animals. And you brought your flocks in, if you could, you brought your animals in to protect them into a walled area. And then later on, when there was more strife in the world, cities were walled also to keep out other people that might hurt you. And the weak part, of course, of any town that has a wall around it is the gate. So the gate, there should only be one, or as few as possible. Especially in a small town, there's probably only going to be one gate, only one way in and out. That keeps it more safe. Now, the thing with a wall and a gate is that everybody has to go through the same opening, right? It becomes this funnel. And it seems sort of intuitive then that a lot of stuff, important stuff that happens, would happen in an area where a lot of people need to go anyway, at the gate, through the gate. And in this town, and they said it was kind of typical for city gates of that area, is that quite often the only open space was just behind the gate, where the square is. Because space is at a premium, because you're trying to crowd everybody and everything into this walled area. Space is at a premium. So really the only open space would have been really right there at the gate. Kind of allows people to go in, come in with their stuff, get their bearings, and then go wherever they need to go. And there may or may not be a market there where a trade would happen. Quite often markets would happen outside or just outside the gate just because space was so crowded. But a lot of stuff would happen. And in this particular gate, there was sort of an outer gate, sort of a lean-to almost on the side of the town. But just inside, you can see these rooms. There's like four little rooms. And that was typical of gates. So what would happen there is often the elders of the town would sit there. and stuff would go on. There would be legal proceedings. Things would get witnessed there. There would be disputes were settled when two people had a dispute with each other, quite often over land or property, they would have it resolved there. And this is before kings, right? This is before there was a king, where each town sort of had its own magistrates, its own sphere of influence. And so people would go there to get their things resolved. And at this point, Boaz gets up and he goes to the town. He goes to the gate where the elders are sitting and he starts making things happen. And he took a seat there. It almost seems that Boaz may have been an elder himself of the town. So he had every right to sort of to be there. In any case, even if he wasn't, he obviously commanded a lot of respect because he was able to get a lot of stuff done and a lot of people together in very short order. That, and I think he was well motivated. Just then, the family redeemer, the other Goel, the nearer kinsman to Naomi, comes along. And Boaz calls out to him, "Come over and sit down, friend. I want to talk to you." So Boaz had said to Ruth earlier that night, in the middle of the night, he says, "I'd love to be your redeemer. However, there is a near kinsman who has dibs on the land. And that has to be taken care of before I can do anything." So this is why he's gone to the gate to find this guy, because he knows he's going to be there at some point anyway. And at the same time, not just that he would be there, but that the other people that need to witness what happens next will be there as well. So he has him sit down. He says, "You know Naomi, who came back from Moab." "Yeah, I know. She's selling the land that belonged to our relative, Elimelech, Naomi's husband. I thought I should speak to you about it so that you can redeem it if you wish. If you want the land, then buy it here in the presence of these witnesses. But if you don't want it, let me know right away, because I am next in line to redeem it after you." Simple request. And he also lets the guy know that if he wants to refuse, it's no foul, because he, Boaz, is next in line and he wants it if he doesn't. So while he's putting pressure on him, the redeemer, to buy the land if he wants, he's also sort of taking pressure off and saying that if you refuse, you're not putting Naomi in a hard spot because I'm here. Okay. So the man replied, "Okay, I'll redeem it." You can imagine Boaz, right? But maybe he expected this too. But now what happens next? It's a little ambiguous. It's almost as ambiguous as what happened at the threshing floor. I know there are some of you sitting here that heard that the last time, and you probably went away unsatisfied, because we don't really know exactly what people's intentions were in going to the threshing floor. And again, I'm sorry, but having read a lot of the top scholars on this, they're not all that certain either, exactly what Boaz is saying and what his intentions were. Because what he says is, "Of course, your purchase of the land from Naomi also requires that you marry Ruth, the Moabite widow." Okay, now that's the way this version says it. It doesn't actually have to mean marry. The word is more broad than that. The word that he uses says you have to acquire Ruth. To further complicate this whole thing, there are two versions of the Hebrew Bible. There is the oral version, and then there's the written version. They are mostly the same for all practical purposes. But they had a tradition, the Hebrews did, that And this was, you know, even long before there were materials to write stuff down with, they would recite things, right? They would recite their law. They would recite the stories. And at this particular juncture in Ruth, there is a difference between what Boaz says between the written version and the oral version. In the oral version, it reads that Boaz says, I intend on taking Ruth as my wife if you purchase the land. Which is a little different from you need to acquire Ruth if you're going to purchase the land. Now what some have surmised that it makes more sense if Boaz says, I intend on taking Ruth myself, which meant to the near kinsman that should Boaz and Ruth have children, then at some point in the future, the land that Naomi had inherited, as it were, from her husband Elimelech, and then through her own sons, and now Ruth is a widow of one of her sons, should Ruth have a child, then the line of succession of that particular land would go through Ruth's son. So even though the kinsmen had the option of redeeming it now, if Boaz and Ruth in particular, had a child, then the land would ultimately then revert back to Ruth's child, in order so that that succession from Elimelech down through Mahlon, Ruth's dead husband, and then now her child would continue. Did you follow that? Now that's what some say. Others say that Boaz was making it up. He was saying, well, if you buy it, then you have to care for Ruth, not necessarily marry her. Because maybe the guy was married. He probably was already married anyway. But other scholars say that Boaz sort of made it up, and he said, well, if you take the land, then you have to care for Ruth as well, and Naomi, her mother-in-law, because they sort of, it's a package deal. Whether or not that was true, we're not sure if that was actually true. Boaz is saying, if that's what he's saying, if that's what, when he's saying, you have to take Ruth, we're not quite sure that that's necessarily true, but it's, if that's what he said, then maybe he was pushing the boundaries of truth. Now, you may not want to believe that about Boaz. I wouldn't want to believe that about Boaz if he was a mighty man of valor, as it says earlier. So I guess I probably would tend to lean towards the oral tradition where he says, I intend to take Ruth anyway, therefore your land may or may not be taken away from you at some point in the future. You can decide. Yourself, of course. I'm just putting it out there for you. Now, the Redeemer now, the potential Redeemer, he says, I can't redeem it. For whatever reason. Now, whether it was because he thought Boaz was telling the truth and saying you have to take Ruth, or whether he thought that the land would be taken away from him at some point in the future anyway, he says, I can't redeem it for whatever reason, because this might endanger my own estate. You redeem the land. I cannot do it. Now, an interesting thing takes place next. It says, now in those days, in those days it was the custom in Israel for anyone transferring a right of purchase to remove his sandal and hand it to the other party. Now, this has caused a lot of people throughout the ages, even really old rabbis writing and interpreting this thousands of years ago, there's been some confusion. Some say this is referring to a leveret marriage transaction. And last time I talked about leveret marriage, and that's where the brother of a man who had died and left a widow would marry the widow. So in order to carry on that brother's name, okay? And that was also an important part of their culture, their society at the time, because widows, that was the only security they had was a man in their life in order to provide for them. Okay, so it was very, very important, and just even the name itself, to carry on your family name is hugely important. And in Deuteronomy, it says that if someone was to refuse to be a person to marry his brother's widow, then the widow in public was to take that man's sandal and spit on him. And that man would be shamed. That obviously does not happen here. So while it kind of looks like it might have something to do with that, personally, I don't think it does. Because Ruth is not there as a widow. The man is not shamed in any way at all. It seems like it's a very amicable transaction. And from other sources, we read that this whole sandal thing was actually not uncommon. So while the law in Deuteronomy may have used that symbol of a sandal in that particular law, it wasn't exclusive to leveret marriage, okay? So the man takes off his sandal, and you kind of wonder, okay, what's that about? And it's deep symbolism, really, especially with land. Your sandal is what you wear all the time, right? Your footwear. It's what touches the ground, between your foot and the ground. It's what touches the ground. And because if you're a society that's so in tune to the land and your possession of it, and that you depend so wholly upon your land, then property value and property possession are pretty high on your priority list. Now, if you're going to give that up, then symbolically, when you take off your shoe, then what you're saying is, I'm giving up the right to walk on this land. And I'm giving that right to you. And in a society where there's no contracts, there's no paper, there's nothing written down, then symbols of this sort are quite important. And particularly if those symbols are witnessed, as we see. Now, in those days, it was a custom in Israel for anyone transferring a right of purchase to remove his sandal and hand it to the other party. This publicly validated the transaction. So the other family redeemer drew off his sandal and said to Boaz, "You buy the land." And Boaz said to the elders and to the crowd standing around, "You are witnesses that today I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon, and with the land I have acquired Ruth, the Moabite widow of Mahlon, to be my wife. This way she can have a son to carry on the family name of her dead husband and to inherit the family property here in his hometown. You are all witnesses today." It's very legal language. It's very technical. So we know just from his words and the way he says them that this is a very legal transaction that's taking place. And everybody that was there, everybody that he gathered, knew that they were witnessing a transaction. So that there could be no question in the future that now the land is Boaz's. And now that he intended to take Ruth. Now there's two parts to that. The first part is Boaz making public his intention to buy the land from Naomi. And that's sort of on a separate level. In addition, he's saying, and it's interesting when you get into it, what he's trying to do. Because his buying the land and redeeming it does not mean that he has to have anything to do with Ruth at all. He's redeeming the land publicly. That's what he wants it to look like anyway. We know from the threshing floor, though, that he's not all that interested in the land. He's really interested in Ruth. And so while publicly he's making this declaration that he's going to buy the land and redeem it, he's keeping that separate from his intentions because there's an issue. And it's sort of, it's way in the background in this story. But the fact remains that Ruth was from Moab. That's still there. That's still sort of this issue in the book of Ruth. And while it is true that people thought she was a good person and that she was considered a woman of valor by all the people in the gate, as Boaz had said, the fact remained was that she was still from Moab. And while they could respect her actions and her words towards Naomi, nobody had yet really taken her in. Ruth and Naomi were still at a point in their community where they could have died from starvation. I want that to sink in a little bit. Despite the fact that people appreciated what Ruth had done, they still looked on her as an outsider, and she was not part of their community. Boaz knows this, and he has to get around it somehow. So he says very carefully, "With the land I have acquired, or will acquire, I will marry." And it's a weird kind of word, because he doesn't say marry. There's better words he could have used for marry. But I think he specifically uses this word, acquire, which seems kind of sexist. But there it is. It'd be sexist today. "With the land I have acquired, Ruth, the Moabite." Now, notice he points that out. She is a Moabite. "Widow of Mahlon, Elimelech's son, to be my wife. This way, she can have a son to carry on the family name of her dead husband and to inherit the family property here in his hometown. You are all witnesses today." So what is Boaz doing? He is trying to get his community to accept Ruth through this back door, as it were, of carrying on Elimelech Mahlon's family name. For him just to take Ruth as his wife, dead stop, I think he would have had a very difficult time. Especially when you live in a community as tight as that. It would have been hard for him to say, "You know what? Forget you. We're gonna live our lives and stuff you guys." I don't think he could have done it, not in a community like that. If he would have been ostracized, then he couldn't have lived there. And anywhere he would have went, he would have had a very difficult life. And he had a lot at stake, of course, in Bethlehem, because he was a respected elder. He had a lot of land. He was obviously fairly well off. So he goes to great lengths in order to convince his community that Ruth, the Moabite, is worth marrying and bringing into their community. Because it's not just him taking her as his wife, but she's going to be part of this community now. And they all have to accept that. It's an important part of the story, it really is. And the community may have said, "We can't accept this." And in which case, this would have been a very different ending. But they don't. They concur. "Then all the elders and all the people standing in the gate replied, 'We are witnesses. May the Lord make this woman who's coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, from whom all the nations of Israel descended. May you prosper in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. And may the Lord give you descendants by this young woman who will be like those of our ancestor Perez, son of Tamar in Judah. So, while at the same time they are accepting Ruth as part of their community and as Boaz's wife, they are also acknowledging that this particular marriage is a strange one because they reference Perez. We talked about that last time. That was another... It wasn't a good situation where Tamar married Judah's son. Judah's son died because he was wicked. And Judah said to his other son, you take Tamar to be your wife. You be the lover. And he didn't really like that. And so while he did take her, he didn't give her a child. And God killed him. That's why God held this up pretty high, right? And then he said, well, Judah said, I can't give you my youngest son right now because he's too young. You have to wait. And years passed. And still, she had no husband. And so she took matters into her own hand. Again, the Bible just sort of recording what happened. And she dressed up as a prostitute, waited by the road, and Judah came by. They had some fun. And later, Judah finds out that his daughter-in-law is pregnant, and so, of course, he's all mad. But she had taken a token from him, something that he had given her, his staff, it was. And she said, this is the father. Who's the father of this child? It's the same person that owns the staff. And Judah eats crow pretty fast. And he says, she is more righteous than I. Interesting words coming, you know, from a man to talk about that of his daughter-in-law who dressed up as a prostitute kind of shows the depths to which they viewed this particular kind of thing, right? She is more righteous than I. Nevertheless, her sons, she had twins. Perez was one of them. And Perez is actually a direct descendant of Boaz. I think. Ancestor. Did I say descendant? I get them mixed up. So the community, in referencing that, they're acknowledging that while that was accepted, that was it's now part of their culture, it's now part of their history. They're saying, this you marrying a Moabite is also a little strange, Boaz, but we're going to accept it anyway. Now to wrap this up as quickly as I can. So Boaz goes to great lengths to convince his community that Ruth is worth it. He's trying his best to show chesed and get his community to show chesed towards Ruth in the same way. This very morning, I was checking Facebook, and a friend of mine posted an article that Keith Dow had written. Some of you know the Dows, right? We're actually living in their house. We live in their old house. And a friend of mine married Keith. I didn't know that he was such a good writer. But anyway, so Keith, he wrote this interesting article in his blog, and it sort of went off a comment that Richard Dawkins had made to somebody, obviously living in New York. And Richard Dawkins, if you don't know, is one of the most famous atheists living today. And he's written a lot of very influential books as an atheist. And this person says, I honestly don't know what I would do if I were pregnant with a kid with Down syndrome. Real ethical dilemma. Richard Dawkins says, abort it and try again. It would be immoral to bring it into the world if you have the choice. This is a public forum, right? Twitter. Lots of people, thousands of people follow Richard Dawkins, yet this comment just exploded. And he's being vilified and called all sorts of names and blah, 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 blah. Lots of chatter about that. But later on then he says, I'm apparently a horde monster for recommending what actually happens to the great majority of Down syndrome fetuses. They are aborted. So what Richard Dawkins is actually saying is that this happens anyway. And now I don't want to get off on the abortion issue because it's not about abortion. It's about something much bigger. And what Keith pointed out was is that Richard Dawkins was speaking truth. And he was reflecting what our culture today has become. And what he says, Keith, is that there's two principles that our culture seems to live by. One is utility, often mixed up with quality of life language. We grade people based on their ability to accomplish, to attain, to contribute. True, right? We see that a lot. And pain avoidance, a moral imperative to avoid suffering at all costs. Pain in our culture is bad. It is morally bad. So to do anything that causes you or others pain, then that's how you measure morality. That's bad. And so by that extension, to bring a child with Down syndrome into the world is to cause yourself difficulty and other people difficulty potentially. Therefore, that's immoral. Twisted kind of world we live in, right? But it is the world that we live in, and it's those kind of comments that are engendered that Richard Dawkins, it's just in keeping with our culture. Now, take Boaz as a redeemer. And I'm not sure that his world was as bad as ours with these kind of imperatives. But I'm sure, you know, people being people, we're all heading in that direction, right? And for Ruth and Naomi and their community to have been in danger of starvation because nobody could step forward to help them for all the multiple reasons that they had, meant that they didn't view, especially Ruth, as a Moabite, as part of their community, as someone who was worth it. And Boaz had to go to great lengths in order to convince his community that she was. Even to sort of deceive them a bit, we're not quite sure, by going in this back door and saying, well, we're going to perpetuate Elimelech's family line. And I see Christ in Boaz, who looks at all of us and says, I want to redeem him and her and him. When the rest of us are looking at each other and even at ourselves, right? And we're saying, we're not worth it. What do we have to contribute to the world? My being here or their being here just causes pain. And that's bad. Whereas Hesed rises above that and says, no, you are worth it. You are intrinsically valuable. And for Boaz, Ruth was intrinsically valuable to him because of the things that he had seen in her. And he did whatever it took in order to redeem her. And Christ has done whatever it took, because we are intrinsically valuable to him. That's why we're here. We can hold up Christ as our hero, our goel, our redeemer, because nobody else was going to step forward. That's the story of Ruth. And there's probably a lot more I could say about it, but we're like way over time. It's there's a lot in there. I think you could probably read that over and over and really enjoy the story. But as you get into it, there's just so much depth. And I encourage you to read Jewish scholars too on Ruth, because they have a huge insight into Ruth. And while they're not going to tie it to Christ, of course, they kind of do anyway, because you read you read their comments, and their comments about God having such loving kindness, and you see, and of course, as a Christian, you say, wow, that's Jesus right there. And that's what his intention was for all of us. And that's just really cool. Let's close in prayer. Father, we thank you for this story. We thank you that you made it happen so that we could enjoy it, that it's in our canon of scripture, that we can muse over it, pick it apart, and see you in it ultimately. I just pray that Ruth, as a story and as a person, would encourage us to be better people, better people of Hesed, where we can see the intrinsic value in each other and in ourselves, ultimately, that value that you hold in us. And it's a value beyond anything that we can understand, because we base our values on such petty things. Just thank you for loving us. Thank you for looking out for us. I thank you for each one here. In Jesus' name, amen.